Today on Maine Calling, what does the second Trump administration mean for Maine? This time yesterday, President Trump was attending a church service in preparation for his swearing-in ceremony at noon. The 24 hours since then have been a whirlwind. First, there was Mr. Trump's speech, which seesawed between words of peace and unity to those of betrayal and retribution. Then came dozens of executive orders, which began in the afternoon and continued into the evening, from pardoning hundreds of January 6 rioters, to withdrawing from the World Health Organization, to calling for an end of birthright citizenship, and more. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the new Trump administration's policies and what they mean for Maine. Already, the ACLU in Maine has announced its role in a lawsuit. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn, and by Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self. MaineHealth.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The Trump administration has begun enacting many of the promises the campaign made during the election. Today, we'll talk about reaction to what has already been set in motion and what it all might mean for Maine. Joining me for the hour, Gene Cummings, former Washington Bureau Chief with the Wall Street Journal, and Nicholas Jacobs, Colby College Associate Professor of Government. He is co-author of the book, The Rural Voter, What Happened to the Vital Center, and the forthcoming book, Subverting the Republic. Gene and Nick, both of you, welcome back to Maine Calling, and thank you so much for joining us. I know that there's going to be no way to talk about everything in 1 hour. Historians will be writing about this 24-hour period, I'm sure, with books for years to come. But we'll try to shed some light on everything that's happened. And Gene, first we had the speech, then the raft of executive orders. Much of it was promised. Did anything surprise you?
There were a few things, but mostly the speech and the orders complemented one another and reflected on one another. So like with any administration, presidents often will use these executive orders to establish the priorities of their administration. And I think that's what Trump was doing with his orders. What surprised me, it was mercifully short. I have not heard a president speak for under a half an hour in, I think, my lifetime. I mean, that was an amazingly concise and brief 25 minutes or the give or take a minute. And I really hope that Trump is ushering in a new era of shorter speeches. Not much chance of that, but I would really be pleased if future presidents followed suit. The other thing that struck me in the speech, not the remarks later, was his outreach to minority communities. It was he did better with Hispanics and Black voters than some of his predecessors. He didn't win a majority, but I thought it was smart that he acknowledged the support from those communities. And I'll be curious how that might influence what he does on the policy side.
Nick, you've spoken with hundreds of rural voters. And I'm wondering, as you have watched everything happen the last 24 hours, are the issues that Trump is acting on the issues that Trump's voters really care the most about? I mean, I've seen criticism that none of these executive orders are going to bring down the price of eggs.
Yeah, and I think we're still waiting to see the full effect and shape of a lot of these orders. I mean, the Trump administration is going to say that action on immigration is going to matter for the economy. The declaration of a national energy emergency is going to matter for one of the significant contributors to inflation, but nobody really knows what a national emergency on energy means. As Jean was getting to, a lot of these orders signal priorities. A lot of these orders are symbolic. And although executive orders are meant to work out the details of legislation and policy, they still need to work out the details of the detail working out thing. Not to mention that a number of the orders that were released yesterday are going to encounter resistance in the courts. I think the most important thing the administration was trying to signal yesterday is that Trump, on the campaign trail, declared himself as a disruptor of the status quo. He was not going to be a member of the Washington establishment. That's the same thing we heard from Trump in 2015 and 2016. His supporters, his loyal customers, as he refers to them, love that about him, and he's coming in to disrupt.
Gina, Nick used the word symbolic, that some of these executive actions, executive orders are symbolic. Which ones are symbolic and which ones will have the law behind them? Which ones can he actually do?
Well, renaming the Gulf of Mexico is, not something he could do with a pen, but it is, a signal of and retaking the Panama Canal. I mean, it's just a signal of a couple of fights he's going to pick. Interesting that they are not domestic fights, they're international fights. And there are many of the executive orders are directing staff to study certain things, so action would come later, but the executive order is laying the groundwork for that action. But overall, what they signal are his priorities, right? So immigration is at the top of it. And that is something that his supporters very much backed him on. And in that way, he's really delivering to those supporters. The executive orders that relate to gender and that sort of thing, that's his fight against the so-called woke society. Here again, many of his supporters really embraced that part of his agenda. So, we said it's going to take a while for these things to work themselves into real policy proposals, but they do signal the priorities of this new administration.
Nick, I want to talk a little bit about the pardoning of the January 6 rioters, with a big question for you. What is the idea behind the presidential pardon? My understanding, this is in the Constitution, that in the Constitutional Convention, Alexander Hamilton argued for it, and that there was some controversy about whether this should be part of the Constitution, part of our country. Why is it? And put into some perspective what happened yesterday.
Yeah, so it is a very controversial power that is given to the presidency. It is a sticky point in a lot of the state ratifying conventions when, right, this draft of this constitution is released and people are trying to understand what this new office of the presidency even is. Hamilton, in describing the pardon power, I mean, he leans on its history. It is a kingly power. It is a power rooted in the British monarchy that was just given to kings in order to grant clemency and mercy. I mean, that's sort of the historical and theoretical language that undergirds pardon, to overcome our excesses in the dispensation of justice when presidents or kings feel that people have been mistreated. So it is a power that is firmly rooted in the history of the presidency. I mean, in comparison to a couple of these other actions that Trump took yesterday, this is one that is clearly understood to be a presidential power. It is not going to be subject to a litany of court challenges and cases as to whether or not Trump can do this. It's done, and the Department of Justice has more or less started taking action to release individuals that Trump pardoned yesterday. The pardon has always been controversial, and you saw controversy before Trump took over with Biden's use of the pardon, not only for his son Hunter in the last couple of weeks of his presidency, but these last minute preemptive pardons, which again, not unprecedented, but not uncontroversial either.
Yeah, it's so interesting. If that was the only thing that happened in the news cycle yesterday, President Biden's mm-hmm. preemptive pardons, that would be something for the history books. Gene, I want to ask you, because you did cover the Trump administration the first time around, what's going to be different this time around, in your view?
I think it's going to be quite different. First of all, if we could go back again on the pardons, I thought it was interesting that he pardoned many of them, most of the nonviolent people, but he commuted the sentences of others, which is not the same as a pardon. Mm-hmm. If they've got felony convictions, they've still got felony convictions. So I found it interesting that, as they had signaled before they took office, that they were going to really take a look at what they were doing and think it through. And apparently they did. Now, how will it be different? The president learned a lot in his first term. So he comes in the second term having a better sense of how to manage the presidency. When he came in the first time, his cabinet picks almost looked like he was trying to cast actors for movie roles. Image was really important in the very beginning. And he's learned substance is also really important. And so the people he's bringing into some of the cabinet positions, they bring in a great fealty to his agenda. Unlike his first cabinet, they were friends, but they weren't loyalists in the way of leading the government. They were just as new to their positions as he was to his own. So this time he's bringing in people like Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, skilled, knowledgeable, knows how to run it. Some of them don't. Some of them will come in, and mostly in kind of the justice area, where they have some experience in that system, but not in running an entire big government. And then the biggest one that kind of breaks the mold is the defense secretary nominee. I mean, he's never run anything close to what he's going to be asked to oversee thousands and thousands and thousands of people work for the Defense Department. I think the biggest place he ever ran had like 900 people. So he looks to be like a kind of a throwback to the first cabinet in the first Trump administration, in that he may be overwhelmed for quite some time as he tries to get a handle on what his job is and how he should execute it. But I don't know that bothers Trump so much, because he's a loyalist, and I think the president feels he could tell this new defense secretary what he wants and what he wants him to do, and he'll follow the orders.
Joining us now is my colleague Kevin Miller, who is State House correspondent for Maine Public. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us, and let's start by talking about Governor Mills. What has her reaction been to the Trump administration so far, and what do you think her strategy is?
Yeah, thanks, Jen. So we haven't heard much yet. Yesterday was a holiday and state government was closed. So folks are really just starting to show up here in the hallways of the State House as far as legislators and seeing folks from the Mills administration. As I said, we haven't heard much yet, but I expect that we will, because so many of what Trump did on that very first day Some of these executive actions will have impacts on Maine, pretty fairly dramatic impacts potentially. Things like the policy changes on offshore wind, immigration policy, and of course, the potential 25% tariff on Canada. Canada is our biggest trading partner by far. In 2023, I saw the figures that Maine shipped $1.4 billion of exports over to Canada. That was 48% of all exports. So if a 25% tariff is put on place on Canada and Canada responds, that's sure to have an impact. Like I said, I fully expect we'll hear more from the governor today. As far as her strategy, the governor has been pretty reserved, I'd say, ever since Trump's election. A bunch of the country's highest profile Democratic governors, folks like Gavin Newsom in California and J.B. Pritzker in Illinois, they quickly made an effort to create this group to safeguard democracy. But Governor Mills didn't join that group when it was first announced. And basically, she said at the time that she will work with President Trump when his policies will benefit Maine, and then she'll oppose him when she thinks that those policies will hurt Maine. So that's kind of where we stand right now.
What does a second Trump administration mean for Senator Susan Collins?
Yeah, that's certainly one of the big and the more interesting issues. Once again this year, I think the big what a lot of folks will be focused on, at least initially, will be how she votes on some of these controversial cabinet nominees like Gene and Nick talked about. People like Pete Hegseth for the Defense Secretary and RFK Jr. for Health and Human Services and Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence. Susan Collins and Angus King are both on the Intelligence Committee, so they're deeply enmeshed in intelligence issues. As we're seeing, there's a lot of pressure from Trump's team and the MAGA base on Republicans to approve these nominees. So she'll be in the spotlight, but again, that's not really anything new with Senator Collins. She was in the spotlight 4 years ago when we were in the same, or rather, not 4 years ago, 8 years ago when we were in the same situation. But looking beyond the nominations, Senator Collins is now the chairwoman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. The two appropriations chairs in the House and Senate are regarded as among the most influential positions in Congress because those committees control the purse strings of the federal government. So Senator Collins will have a lot of influence about whether to fund or not fund some of the policy priorities that come from the Trump administration. So again, she'll be in the spotlight. There'll be a lot of pressure on her, but again, that's probably nothing new when it comes to Senator Collins. She frequently finds herself in that position.
Kevin, you already mentioned offshore wind. You mentioned tariffs. I understand you're also watching to see what kind of changes there might be, if any, to Medicare or Medicaid and Social Security. Why?
Yeah, I mean, those are such important programs, certainly across the country, but especially here in Maine, given our demographics. We are a state that's consistently one of the oldest states in the country. We have a lot of folks who depend on Medicare and Medicaid, and those programs are in financial trouble. There have been a lot of Republicans talking about changes that could be made to it. President Trump hasn't been clear about what his priorities would be. And I think any changes to that, whether it's increasing the age for eligibility or reducing benefits, that those could have dramatic impacts on Maine. So that's kind of a big wait and see to see what happens.
Well, Kevin, thanks so much for joining us today. Kevin Miller, Maine Public's State House correspondent. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're discussing changes under the new administration and what they might mean for Maine. With me, Colby College professor Nicholas Jacobs and former Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau chief Gene Cummings. What are you thinking about today, the day after the Trump inauguration? What are you thinking about in terms of something that you're involved with here in Maine? Calling in now is Aaron Frey, who's Maine's Attorney General. Aaron, thanks so much for calling back.
Jennifer, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate the time with your panelists and your listeners. Certainly been a busy 24 hours.
Yeah, you joined us last week to talk about potential ramifications to Maine if certain immigration policies are enacted or overturned, and wanted to know what your initial reaction to the executive orders signed yesterday is.
Well, in many similar ways to what's already been described, what we're seeing is a fair amount of symbolic activity. It's meeting the campaign promises that we knew were coming down the pike. I am concerned about the ways in which these promises, these executive orders, may be isolating the United States, decreasing our influence across the globe, disregarding federal law when it comes to the executive order looking at TikTok, and sanctioning behavior that was violent and anti-democratic back on January 6th of 2020. I've already been on the phone with a number of my colleagues last night going through the executive orders in real time as they were being released. And, you know, as Maine's chief legal officer, I'm going to be evaluating, you know, what the impact on Maine is, whether or not the law, federal law, state law, supports the action that the president is taking. And when appropriate, if Maine is impacted, for example, if funding is threatened, if appropriate, I will consider legal action on behalf of the people of Maine.
Yeah, you mentioned funding. Mr. Trump has suggested he might withhold federal funds from states that don't abide by his wishes. What areas are you anticipating that this might happen?
So we saw this in my first term as Attorney General when we had President Trump serving his initial term. He sought to divert defense spending that would benefit defense projects here in Maine. He sought to divert that to the border wall that was not authorized by Congress. And it was just a policy priority that he had. That was one example. I think we may see it in the Department of Education. We could see it on the healthcare spend side. You know, there is some talk right now that the president may put conditions on FEMA relief for California, for example. I suspect if Maine, which is increasingly experiencing the impact of climate change through our increased storms, we might very well have to watch what sort of relief we're going to get from the federal government if we're not in the president's good graces. That is not the way that our country is supposed to operate. I'm hoping that that's not going to be the case. We are watching it, though, as a potential risk.
Aaron, thank you so much. That was Maine Attorney General Aaron Fry. I'm going to go to some questions from the audience here. A question from Diego on Facebook. If he didn't put his hand on the Bible that Melania was holding, did he swear a false oath? Gene, do you know the answer to the question?
I don't know the answer, but it is an interesting question. When I was reading up on how that came to be, there are some explanations that the First Lady was a little beat behind in getting the Bibles close so that he could put his hand there, and that was the mistake. But, you know, and it could have been a choice. I don't know. I'm not inside of the president's head. And he hasn't really explained why that happened. I do think that it still would be considered an oath of office because he said the words and, you know, the Bible was present and the ceremony was completed as dictated under the Constitution. So I still think an oath's an oath.
Nick, you're nodding your head in agreement.
Constitution says nothing about placing your hand on a Bible. Just you have to take the oath. It's a special oath. The president is the only one of our officers that takes the presidential oath, and that's the oath he took. You know, there was an interesting moment because they had to move this ceremony indoors sort of last minute. The Constitution does say that the former president's term of office ends precisely at noon. And I think what happened was they were adjusting the schedule, and when Roberts stood up to deliver the oath, they were trying to get that taken care of pretty quickly, and it sort of threw off Melania's and family's arrival to the podium.
Gene, I want to return to something we talked about with Kevin. He looked at talking about Senator Collins' role, head of appropriations, but also in a position where, you know, she has criticized and voted against President Trump in the past. And I'm wondering from your perspective in Washington, what you see Senator Collins' role is during this Trump administration, what the challenges she faces will be.
She will have a very important role, and you all know her better than I do. I covered her in Washington for decades and know her from that experience. And I think she relishes the opportunity to play an important role in things in Washington. So it will create some pressure on her, no doubt about it, but she won't be alone. She and Murkowski and other, you know, there still is this core group of senators that support one another. And I think that she's not afraid of controversy. She tends to make up her mind on what she thinks is best for the country and stick by it. So far, she hasn't signaled a break of any kind, but the fights ahead are big. I mean, we have the debt ceiling coming up really soon, and that will be a major issue for folks in Washington to deal with, and she'll be part of that, in addition to the cabinet nominations. So I think my experience with Senator Collins is that she's not afraid of that pressure, and she's not afraid of controversy, assuming that she thinks she has thought things through and is going to make the right decision for your state or the country.
Nick, do you want to add to that?
Well, picking up on what Jean and Kevin also highlighted, as chairwoman of the Appropriations Committee, she is likely to be drawn into to one of the fights that I'm previewing, which is over this sort of curious, obscure, novel, you can pick the adjective, but this idea that the Trump administration put forward during their transition about the president's ability to impound funds. So here's Susan Collins overseeing a congressional process of appropriating money, saying that you have to spend this money. This is what Congress has decided, and she'll have a very prominent role in determining those appropriations bills and guiding them through the legislative process. And the Trump administration has sort of revived this idea that was last prominent during the Nixon administration, that the president gets to actually choose whether they get to spend those monies. And so when you think about congressional funding for any number of programs and areas that the Trump administration might not want to see, you're going to see a clash of institutions here and undoubtedly court cases. And I think Collins is going to be central to that.
On the line with us is Molly. Go ahead, Jean.
Just adding one more thought to the potential clashes that Nick speaks of. I think declaring the border a national security crisis, that also could be an opening for the Trump administration to not wait for congressional authority, but just use whatever money they get their hands on to build the wall and just avoid Congress altogether. And they could set their own priorities in that spending. I don't know that they're going to do it, but I know that that is a door that opened with that declaration, and we'll see what they do in the future.
On the line with us now, Molly Curran-Rolls, who's executive director for the ACLU of Maine. Molly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I understand the ACLU has already filed a lawsuit regarding some of the new administration's executive orders, specifically that about birthright citizenship, that Maine ACLU is part of this. It is from Concord, New Hampshire. You're partnering with the New Hampshire ACLU and some other organizations. Tell me about this suit and what you hope that it does.
Yeah, thank you. So the lawsuit charges the Trump administration with flouting the Constitution's dictates and congressional intent and longstanding Supreme Court precedent. Birthright citizenship is the principle that every baby born in the United States is a U.S. citizen. And the 14th Amendment guarantees the citizenship of all children born in the U.S., with a very narrow exception of children of foreign diplomats, regardless of race or color or ancestry. And so through this case, our intent is to make clear that the principle of birthright citizenship has been undisturbed constitutional bedrock for over a century and must be maintained.
What do you foresee happening with this? Do you believe it will be fast-tracked to the Supreme Court? I mean, there are children being born probably already that would be affected by this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it will be interesting to see what path this takes, but certainly we see the history of welcoming new Americans through birthright citizenship as central to our country's strength. And this is such a fundamental repudiation, not only of settled law, but also of our values at a core level.
Clearly, this lawsuit was ready to go. Any other executive orders that the ACLU is already working to block or try to block?
You know, we work to uphold civil rights and civil liberties in a range of ways, and so we'll continue to be working through the courts, through the legislature, and through public fora, and, you know, actively monitoring, as we have been, the administrative the policies that are coming from the administration over time. We have a lot more detailed information on our website and encourage people to be following along, because things will continue to change in real time pretty rapidly.
All right. I'm wondering specifically about some of the gender declarations. Is this something that the ACLU sees an opportunity for filing a lawsuit or taking effective action?
I mean, certainly our work does focus on a range of discriminatory areas. And so we're looking carefully at this and again, working in coalition with many other organizations to determine the best way forward. But we're very concerned about a number of the things that we're seeing.
All right. Well, thank you so much for giving us a call. Molly Curran-Rolls with ACLU of Maine. Let's see, another question here from Kathy. Do you think the new administration will try to reverse the changes to Social Security that Biden signed in December, the reverse of the windfall law for state employees with pensions? And that's really interesting question, very important question here in Maine. Gene, this was passed by Congress, signed by President Biden. Can it be undone?
I'm not sure that that is a way that Trump will go. And the reason I say that is, if you even go back to his first campaign and administration, Trump often talked about Social Security as a pact between people and their government. And he didn't propose any changes and has told and said on the campaign trail, he's not going to change Social Security in a harmful way. So that may be something that he, given it's passed, you know, a Republican House, it may be something that he does not disrupt. That's an area that I think he doesn't really view himself as a disruptor. Now, if you're on Medicaid, that's different. And that may be an area that he supports changes in. He had said Medicare and Social Security were safe. So that's his promise. And I would think, given his experience and his actions, he kept those promises when he was in his first term. I suspect he'd keep them again.
All right. Well, we are talking, of course, about the Trump administration, which is less than 24 hours old. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today, the impacts of the new administration's actions. My guest, Nicholas Jacobs, who's Associate Professor of Government and Faculty and Faculty Associate Director at Colby College. He is co-author of the book, The Rural Voter, What Happened to the Vital Center? And his forthcoming book is Subverting the Republic. Jean Cummings is also with us. She is the former Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. A question here about electric cars from Paul. One of Trump's executive orders took aim at electric vehicles, revoking Biden's goal that half of all new vehicles sold in the U.S. be EVs. Will the auto industry just continue on the path they were on to meet Biden's EV goals anyway? And how does this anti-EV stance sit with Elon Musk, who seems to have inordinate influence in the new administration? So have either of you been looking into this?
It's likely that the automotive industry is not going to make drastic changes because they might anticipate whiplash in federal policy in 2 years when Congress may change, or 4 years when a new administration comes in. It seems like, although federal policy does matter quite a bit in nudging industry to meet goals, and markets are more powerful, and this market is becoming increasingly well established here and especially abroad. Now, one of the things that will matter, I think, more in the immediate short term are federal subsidies for these types of technologies, not only for our EVs, but for solar panels on our roofs, for other types of renewable energies. On the campaign trail, those were clear targets of Trump's rhetoric and his transition team. And so, you might be seeing an end to those sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and Gene, related to the EV question is the drilling question. President Trump likes to say drill, baby, drill, but does that mean that the oil companies are going to start drilling?
Well, that remains to be seen. I mean, what has always surprised me is that the number of approved permits for drilling always is bigger than what's actually happening on the ground. So it's not that there's a lack of opportunity or permission for them to drill, but it takes a lot of effort on the part of the industry to get those kinds of operations up and running. So I think drill, baby, drill, is probably more a signal that he doesn't support alternative fuels and he wants to preserve the oil industry. And, he can approve a bunch of permits, but like I said, they've always exceeded the number of actual operations on the ground. So the industry has had ample opportunity to expand. And, and it's up to them to choose where they're going. But it's not any, you don't flick a light switch and create a new drilling site. So it's hard.
We'll go to Mary, who's calling from Northport. Hi, Mary, go ahead.
Hello. I was hoping that we could hear more today or and ongoingly about what the challenges are actually going to be to President Trump. He can't just sign an executive order and wave a wand and make these things happen right away. There will be challenges, legal ones, and hopefully from the general public and others that can have some impact. And it takes time, lots of time. So I think it's important before everybody gets freaked out and terrified, that we all are a little bit anyway, that we understand that it's made clear that he doesn't just sign an order and and the thing happens right away. So I thought I just wanted to say, could you say more about that either today or some other day?
Yeah, and Nick, it depends, doesn't it? Because, the executive order to pardon the January 6 rioters, many are actually being released, correct? So there are some things that don't take time, but there are things, as to Mary's point, that will be
That's
challenged
correct,
and
but
will
they're
take
still making
time.
money.
What is your reaction to what Mary has to say?
Well, Mary's absolutely correct. And within the minutiae of some of these orders, there's an acknowledgement for a period of implementation. If I'm remembering correctly, sorry, there were only a few dozen to get through. I mean, with the end of birthright citizenship for children of undocumented persons at here, I think there's a 30-day lag in implementation, almost anticipating a court order for that. But I will say, in a number of areas that we saw action on yesterday, the president's authority is pretty clear, especially in those changes directly relating to the operations of the Federal Civil Service. Those might not be the loudest or the ones that have the most fanfare surrounding them, but those are the types of orders and personnel and operational changes that have long-lasting effect on the president's ability to carry out later executive orders or later memoranda. One of the ones that's, it's gone noticed, but there has been a lot to cover, was the re-implementation of a plan that the Trump administration tried to push through in late 2020, which deals with the reclassification of federal civil servants that are involved with policy matters. It was called Schedule F then. They've given it a new name, but the same sort of intent, which is to weaken the civil service protections given mostly to senior civil servants. Now, when it comes to thinking about why Trump is not immediately able to do whatever Trump wants to do, a lot of that has to do with federal civil servants that stand in the way and ask questions or drag their heels or follow the actual processes of administrative law. So one way you get around that is you remove some of their civil service protection. So, you know, to Gene's point earlier, you're seeing, I think, a leaner and meaner Trump 2.0, a Trump that administration that's learned some lessons from its first 4 years in office, especially about governance.
And Gene, I'm wondering some of what he's talked about with federal workers, and it's important to remember that most do not work in Washington. Aren't there unions that have a role in these orders?
Absolutely. There is a very big union that represents federal employees, and they've been preparing for this, you know, even before Election Day. They saw that threat coming, and they are preparing to file lawsuits and to try to protect the federal workers. The other threat to the federal workforce, of course, is whatever Elon Musk is up to, where if he wants to slash government spending, but in order to do that, there just aren't that many pockets where he can go to get the kind of numbers, which even he has already kind of walked back, recognizing that if you have Social Security, you have Medicare, you have Medicaid, you have these entitlement programs and the Defense Department, and then you've got very little left that you can go pick on to try to get savings. So obviously one thing that could emerge as a very big target for his project is the Pentagon.
All right, Mary, thanks so much for your question. Gene, we've talked mainly about domestic policy so far in this hour, but Trump said something a little surprising, at least to people who watch his statements about Vladimir Putin yesterday. Talk about that and what you think it signals.
I was very surprised by the president's criticism of Putin. He said that Putin is ruining Russia. He's never said anything remotely like that before. And it's very unclear to me what it means and what it signals, but Trump did say during the campaign he was going to intervene in the Ukraine-Russia war in some way. He said he would, you know, end it in the blink of an eye or something to that effect. And, you know, everyone knew, okay, it's not going to be easy. But the assumption was, however he may push to try to get the parties to resolve their conflict, that he would favor Russia in the process. So those remarks about Putin were, to me, a little extraordinary. And he has not talked to Putin yet. He said he's going to talk to him this week, I believe. But it signaled some kind of change, but I'm not quite sure how big or small it might be.
All right. We have an email here from Dan. I work in the solar sector and wonder what your panelists think Trump will do about incentives like the 30% tax credit for residential solar and other incentives for heat pumps. We're getting those questions from many of our customers since Trump was elected in November. So, Nick, why don't you give some advice to Dan? What would you tell his customers if you were in his shoes?
Well, I've already alluded to the idea that this is going to be one of the policy areas we'll see some change in. It's likely it is going to require congressional action. I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of the year we see another big sort of legislative attempt to rework the tax code in which a lot of these subsidies and tax credits are often contained, and this would be similar to Trump's first year in office. Of course, this won't affect what the state of Maine does independent of the federal government, and so your Maine state legislature over the last couple of years has expanded those through their own state budgetary powers, but when it comes to federal subsidies and federal incentives, this might be one of the areas in which Musk and the Department of Governmental Efficiency are going to be trying to pinch pennies and find some savings.
Just to be clear, though, are these subsidies in place until there's a change?
Yes, they would be in place until there's a change, and it would require some. It takes time to implement changes to tax code and federal subsidies.
And Jennifer, I'd just add, we cannot underestimate the automakers' influence in Congress. They appealed to the incoming administration for consistency. They've rebuilt their factories in order to meet the goals set by Biden. And many of them asked the administration not to make an extreme course correction. And I wouldn't underestimate their influence when any of this goes to Congress.
An email here from James regarding Senator Collins. He writes, "I totally disagree. She has been an enabler of Trump. She never said she did not vote for Trump." And I'm thinking, Jean, if you can talk about, and I don't want to, only talk about Senator Collins here, but I'm imagining when you are Senator Collins, you have to pick your battles. And how does she think about that? Or how somebody in her position would be thinking about that. You've covered Congress for a long time.
Well, I think that's the most striking difference at the start of this term as opposed to the last, that members of Congress as a whole have recognized that a 4-year war with Trump, ultimately, Biden beat him, but it's exhausting. And Trump really thrives in combat. And so, if you notice, the Democrats are really laying low right now. Part of it is because they don't have a leader, and that's a big part. But it's not, they aren't without leaders. I mean, Schumer's there. I've noticed that, the Republicans run the show. They seem to be giving them some rope and see what happens. That's where Collins could have an influence in taking some of the sharp edges off of some of the proposals. I mean, it is true that what the caller notes is she voted for Kavanaugh, and Kavanaugh made some kind of commitment to her about Roe v. Wade and then broke his commitment. I don't know if she's learned from that or not, but she is at least in a position to implement, to be a curb on some things, and we'll see if she's willing to do it. My experience in watching her and some of the other, particularly the female senators, is that they are willing to band together on occasion and stand their ground. We'll see if they do it again.
I have an email here from Michelle, and Michelle is a professor at the University of Southern Maine. She writes, "I'm preparing for my first class of the spring semester, and I'm already getting notes from my college students. What can we do to help? Organizations and calling for action seem to largely be soliciting funds. My students don't have a lot of spare funds, but they and I really want to take action to protect the vulnerable, to assist agencies confronting the agenda. What practically can we do?" Nick, are you getting similar questions? And what are you telling the students that you work with, that you teach?
There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of anxiety among young people who feel like their friends and their families and friends of families are under direct attack. That a lot of this agenda against wokeness that Jean spoke about earlier are specifically directed towards college students and the communities they come from. It might sound academic and a little trite, but I think the first thing is to stay informed and stay vigilant. And so far as we gotta watch what's actually going on, and don't forget that there's other points of influence outside of DC, including in our main state legislature.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for joining us for this hour. The voice you just heard, Nick Jacobs, Colby College Associate Professor of Government and the author of the forthcoming book, subverting the republic. And Gene Cummings, former Wall Street Journal chief, Washington Bureau chief. Thanks so much, Gene, for joining us. Today's sound engineer was Chris Bridges. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we begin a new series for this year, Living with a Disability. For our first episode, we focus on transportation and getting around here in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.